Hello, guys, and welcome to another episode. I'm so glad to have you here, and I'm even more glad to have my new guest up today. His name is Steve Marks, and he is the author of Braxton's Turn. And this is a really unique, really, really cool book and angle on this book. So I can't wait to share this with you. Steve, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Awesome. So this is everything that you've done with this book, I feel like is really, really unique. And that is such a hard thing to do right now because every story's been told. You know, that's what it feels like. Every story's been told, everything's been done. And this is actually pretty unique. So I'm excited. So it's Braxton's Turn is the name of the book. And your protagonist's goal is to advocate for, I have to read it, for more medical research funding to find a cure for type 1 diabetes. And that alone is a really interesting thing, because I feel like we don't hear that in fiction stories, really. This isn't like a thing, but you have a really compelling reason and a whole story and concept behind this. So take me from the beginning of the formation for the idea of this book.
Okay. First, let me say that the story about finding the cure or story of life with type 1 really hasn't been told well in the media. There have been a lot of references to it in different shows. Some stories, it involves, you know, the experiences of a type 1, but they've never really been accurately told. And only a person that is living with the disease or caring for or a loved one of somebody with the disease really understands what the day-to-day struggle with life is. So when my niece was diagnosed as a type 1 diabetic, going back to, I think it was 2003, she was 3 years old, I had never heard of the disease, but had no familiarity with it. And at the time, she was living in about 400 miles away in Reno, Nevada. Her and her family moved back down close to me. I got to be close to her, and I got to see up front what it's like, not only for her. And of course, she's only 3-4 years old. She didn't really understand what life without diabetes was. So she was used to the finger pricking and the blood testing and the watching of the diet. That's all she knew. But it was tremendously hard on my brother and my sister-in-law, led to their breakup as a marriage eventually. But the way the story came about was I became very interested in learning more about the disease, and I felt a compelling need to do something. I had a successful business at the time, and I saw this as a way to give back. So I started to become involved with organizations that were involved in advocacy. I started giving money to a particular group that I liked. It was actually a group of law enforcement officers, a local, I know that has relevance to you, Elsa. So our local sheriff, Randy Pentis, had a son who was type 1 diabetic, and he formed a group called Cops Riding for Charity. And what they would do is they would travel with their bikes to the outermost reaches of the planet, and they would ride to raise money. And I thought that was very, very cool. So I started writing them checks every year. Randy introduced me to a lady that represented an organization called JDRF, used to be known as the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, but because more and more people are living longer with the disease, they just shortened it to the acronym. Mm. And I developed a program in my company to raise money to give back. We would give a percentage of every sale to JDRF. It was a lot of money over a 4-year period. So I was invited to join the LA board of JDRF. Nothing special. The board members are just people that can raise money. You don't have to have any other talent than that to be a board member. And I started to learn about the disease. I started to learn about the medical research community and how they were striving to develop a cure, better therapeutics, treatments, but they weren't going anywhere. And this was despite millions and millions of dollars of U.S. government funding. There was a lot of frustration, even back, this was 2011 timeframe, there was a lot of frustration in the community, all this money being thrown at it, always being promised a cure, and it was always 5 years away. So the idea of a story sort of took root in me, and that was, what if there was just a guy who had all the right stuff to push through all of the political or lack of political will through the medical industrial complex and all their, perhaps motivations for not developing a cure. It was a big business. Diabetes treatment is a big business. So if you're fighting for the cure, you're going to be messing with a lot of people's profit streams. So I'm also, besides, being in business and having interest now in type 1 diabetes, I was always a political news junkie. I was always totally entertained by the hypocrisy, the BS, all the messaging. And I just put all those three things together into a story. And that's what the book is all about. It's about a guy who hates politics, very successful business guy. All of a sudden, his son is diagnosed with the disease, and it turns him to a journey to find the cure. And he decides to go where the money is, which is the U.S. Congress. So he goes into politics with one agenda item, and that is to do whatever it takes to develop the cure.
Wow. Wow. What, so incredible inspiration for the story and for the real life aspect of it. What you chose to do in your real life to help and make a difference and understand, and, so many people choose not to do that because, they're busy and it's complicated and all of those things. And I'm just so impressed that you really took such initiative to learn more and to advocate and do things, on behalf of. I can tell you honestly, I know next to nothing about diabetes. I don't know anything. I'm lucky enough to say that I don't have anyone in my personal life that experiences that, so it's very peripheral for me and probably for so many people. As for the political end of it, oh boy, did you hit a lot of nails on the heads with that one. Like you said, it's big business, and lots of money is involved. And I think that's a very accurate statement that they don't really want to find a cure, these government entities and big pharma and all. They don't want a cure because, there goes all their money. So I love that you created this character to go and do really what we all wish we could do or even knew how to do. Tell me about some of the, because this is a pretty in-depth book when you're talking about politics and medicine and lobbying and all of these things. What was the research like for this book? Were there any surprises for you?
I think I was a little bit surprised at how many. Well, let me say, I think I was surprised in learning that there are all these organizations out there that are exploring different avenues for the cure. And there's very, very little collaboration. So it's like, I think, and I write about this in the sequel. So I do have a sequel to the book coming out, because where the story ends, where the book ends is not where the story ends. The story continues on. And I don't want to give away the ending to the book, but our protagonist makes it pretty far up the political ladder, almost to the top. But in the sequel, I really develop his strategy for, he's in a position of great power. I'll let you guess what his office is. But if there's a picture of the White House anywhere, you can kind of get an idea where he ends up. But in the sequel, this is where it's like, okay, I've got the platform, I've got the power, I've got the voice. Now I can make the cure happen. What does he do to do that? He's got a lot of forces that he's fighting. But to answer your question, what I became as I was researching different ideas of what one in that office with that power could do to relieve all this suffering, I started looking into, and I spoke to a lot of people involved in the research community. And a lot of most of the people that are successful in the research community, they ain't working for Big Pharma. Big Pharma is not really interested in that. They're interested in the therapeutics and the treatments and the revenue. It's much more dedicated, much more serious people, many times underfunded or lightly funded, that are trying to break through the science to figure out why and I'll just diverse a little bit into the medical scene right now, but why a young child, all of a sudden, their immune system goes off the rails and starts attacking their pancreas and kills all of the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the book, the medical research community did not know the cause, and there was no cure on the horizon. That was when I first started writing, 2011. 12 years later, there still is no known reason for the disease. You know, we don't know the cause, and we're still 5 years away from the cure, 12 years later. And in talking to some of these very dedicated researchers, I learned that there's very, very little collaboration amongst them. And in trying to understand why, the opinions I were given were that, you know, a lot of people are very interested in the fame and fortune that will come from saying, I found the cure for type 1 diabetes. You know, much as Jonas Salk with polio, you know, that's a big deal. And there is a lot of ego involved. Mm. And there's also a lot of money involved, because people, they want to be the ones to develop the patent or put their name on the patent to the cure. Hence, there's not as much collaboration. So,
I guess I would have thought that this was a, you know, nationwide, maybe, you know, across the world, around the world, all of these people working together towards this common goal of finding a cure. And you're explaining that that's not the case at all. These are, you know, pockets of research being done and being funded by fundraising efforts and things like that. And they're not working together. So that's wild to me, and not in a good way, in a really like disheartening and frustrating way. Like you understand why Big Pharma doesn't want any part of that. You understand why government doesn't want any part of that. Again, and you know, it's all about money, right? And here in this too, I guess that's part of the case. It's a very shocking underbelly to all of this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but I want to make sure your listeners know that the book was written to be a lighthearted source of inspiration for the T1D, type 1 diabetes community. So it's not dark and sad and emotional. It's the characters are quirky. They make incredible things happen through a lot of ingenuity and hard work. There's a lot of comedic situations. And I really wrote it for people in the T1D community to be able to read it and go, you know, yeah, we can find the cure. It just, you know, we just have to wait a little longer. The right guy is going to come along, or the science is going to happen, and we're going to have the cure, because there is a lot of frustration in the community. A lot of people are losing hope. You know, type 1 diabetic, they have to manage the disease every minute of every day. So a lot of people, you'll see them now. It's become very popular to wear these continuous glucose monitors, these CGMs. Mm-hmm. They're little patches that you'll see on people's, typically on their upper forearm or their upper arm. And it's becoming, you know, it's a very difficult disease to manage. It requires a lot of discipline around diet, around checking your blood, reacting to high or low readings. And there's a lot of frustration in the community. So I was hoping to provide just a little inspiration for them and hope.
I love that. I love that. Tell me, you mentioned some quirky characters and some comedy in there, lightheartedness. And I love that because I think when you are dealing with a serious topic like that, you need to have those moments of levity so that people can just remember, like, it's okay. It's going to be okay. You know, let's just laugh a little bit here. Who's your favorite character? Do you have a favorite character in your book?
Well, our guy, his name is Jonathan Braxton, and we refer to him a little bit as JB. Now, I also understand those are the initials of the current president, but when I started writing the book, he wasn't the president, and I had no idea that it was going to present a little, challenge for recognition down the road, but I'll call him John
there
Braxton.
Okay.
He has an executive assistant named Abby Martin. And she is, he's quirky, right? He's very quirky and he does weird stuff like he's playing fantasy baseball. He's running a multi-billion dollar company and he'll take a half hour out of his day to pick a fantasy baseball team. He needs to think through a complex subject. So what he does is he closes the door to his office. He pulls out these darts and he starts throwing darts at a dartboard. And he starts talking to his dartboard, which he's named Captain Crunch. So he has a meeting with Captain Crunch about, you know, running his company, but it's his way of focusing and thinking of things. And she's just like constantly making fun of him, ripping into him. She always refers to him as Your Highness, Your Majesty, My Lord, Sire, in a playful way. And he, really appreciates her. You know, he's not taken aback by it, but just her way of kind of keeping him in check. And she's also sort of a spirit animal for him. So down the road in the story, he's in Congress. He's getting very frustrated. He can't make things happen. He walks into her office. He starts whining. She goes, I ain't listening to that. If you want to whine, get out of my office. This is what she's telling her boss. She proceeds to tell him everything that he's done right, all the progress he's made, you know, all the things he needs to be proud of and the reason he needs to keep going. And he doesn't have time to complain. So she's sort of his right arm. And I try to make her as insanely funny as possible with all kinds of weird things going on. And so she's my favorite.
I love it. Now this sounds to me, you know, so I do this a lot. I do this all the time. When anybody tells me a story, whether we're talking about a book or just a story that they're telling me, I always see everything in my head as a movie. Like it's always playing like a video in my head, which leads me to my next question. Any plans for this to hit the big screen or small screens, any screens in the future?
Yeah, we actually have an ongoing effort with that right now. In LA here, there's a company called Voyage Media that I hooked up with. Their business model is to work with independent content creators to help them bring their stories to Hollywood. Because Hollywood's a very structured, difficult industry to crack into. And this company has developed a formula to help authors, screenwriters, storytellers have their stories told on the screen. So it's not automatic. You have to pitch a producer, and a producer decides whether or not the story is marketable. So I paid a little money. I pitched a producer. He loved it. And now we're in progress of approaching studios and networks to adapt the story for the screen. I've been told that it would probably be a streaming series, not a movie. There's just a lot of risk for studios right now in producing movies. And without a well-known actor or a known writer or, you know, someone who's got a track record in the industry, mm-hmm. to get behind them, it's very difficult. And yet the streaming providers are very hungry for content. So they're all looking for good stories.
I think it's a better angle anyhow, or better avenue, I should say. I love streaming. So yeah, I'm all about that. That's the one I would, that's the one I would want you to do. Silly question though. You ready? Who would you picture playing John Braxton?
Not a silly question, because this was in my head as I was writing the story. I have two, actually, that I think would be my two favorite. First would be Ryan Reynolds. His timing and his facial expressions and just his tone. When I was writing the story, I was kind of writing it, okay, what would Ryan Reynolds say in this situation, or how would he react?
I love that. I can totally picture that.
My second choice, and we're actually actively pursuing Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, yeah.
In that he's expressed some political aspirations. Mm-hmm. Whether he still has those or not, I'm not sure. But if he is looking for a role that would cast him in a positive light, and I think my character, at least the way it's written in the book, I understand in a screenplay it could be changed quite a bit, but he's, as it's written in the book, he's very similar to what I believe Matt's political philosophies are and his points of view. So I think those two would be great as the lead.
That is so cool. Yeah, I could picture, I haven't read that. Full disclosure, I haven't read the book yet. I did my highlights reading and everything. It's in my to be read list. But yeah, based on our conversation and based on what I read about the book, I could totally see either one. Yeah. 100%. How fun is that?
Yeah. Actually, I don't have any experience as a screenwriter, but I went to a writer's club meeting in my local area. And this was about 6 months ago. And teaching at the meeting was a scriptwriter professor from UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara. And he was talking about screenwriting. And I never really thought of trying to take a stab at it and try to adapt my story. But I started writing a screenplay, realizing I did not know the first thing about it. And it took me a while, but I ended up writing a full 10 episode screenplay adapted from the book. Now, as I mentioned to you, Voyage Media before, and we're working together. So one of the things to kick off the project was, they determined that we needed a pilot script to have something to pitch to a network. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we actually went out and hired a Hollywood screenwriter, and he wrote a pilot episode script for the story as well. So that we have a little bit of traction in that direction.
That is so crazy, crazy cool. And I love hearing that. And I love that I have you on my show so that when you're a big deal, and not that you're not a big deal, in the eyes of the world, I get to say, yeah, I interviewed that guy. I know him. Yeah, Steve and I, we go way back. So just saying, I'm getting bragging rights right now.
if any of your viewers would like to know more about the story without making the time commitment and the monetary commitment to buy the book, we do have a website up, which is kind of written from the point of view of the character. So it's the book website featuring John Braxton, but I have profiles for all the main characters in the book. Braxton has some policy positions that he brings to Washington with him. And so I have those on the website. He has his own blog. One of his interviews is with Thomas Jefferson. So I brought Thomas Jefferson back from the grave to interview with John. And they talk about how he would react to the way our politics in the country are today.
Oh, boy. And yeah, I would love to read that for sure.
I write about social issues.
I love that. And I'm glad that you brought that up. I had said that early in the conversation that you took a really unique approach to your marketing, which was to really put your characters center stage, put them in the spotlight in your marketing. And so it's not you talking, it's your characters talking. So, you know, through your social media and your website, of course, people are really already immersed in your characters, which I think was a brilliant idea and really, really cool. I love that you did that. Did you just decide to do that on a whim or?
Well, the characters are much more interesting than I am. So we figured, you know, if somebody's going to sell the book, they'll probably have a better chance at it than I will.
I love that. That's too funny.
I don't know how the idea came to me. It just sort of.
It's really, really cool. Everything about it is cool. Do me a favor. Tell everybody again, the website, where they can find your book to purchase as well. And are you doing any book signings, any appearances anywhere? If so, throw them out there so people know where to find you.
Still working on that. So nothing scheduled right now, but we have a website up. It's www.braxtonsturn.com. Let's Go Braxton will also redirect to that page. So letsgobraxton.com. And we have a Instagram account up at Jonathan Braxton. And we have a Facebook page up. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact handle, but
that's okay. I'll find it. I'll make sure I put him up on the screen. You guys, when you all see this, you'll see it going right across the screen. So you'll know where to find everything. Steve, I can't thank you enough for coming on and telling us about your book and all of the exciting things coming up for it. I can't wait to watch this I won't name one because we don't know which one it'll be on yet. So on my favorite streaming platform, whichever that one might be, I look forward to seeing this on there. It's going to be very, very cool. And I'd love to have you back on again when the next book is released. If you feel like coming on back, you have an open standing invite.
Fantastic. Appreciate it, Elsa. Thank you for the time.
Oh, awesome. No, thank you so much. Okay, guys, thank you so much for tuning in today. It was great having you here with us and listening in. I hope you'll go check out the book and the website and all of the good things that Steve Marks has. That is Braxton's Turn. Go check it out. It's a great story and for a great cause, too. So take care. We'll see you in the next episode.
Hey, family, if you're looking for the perfect gift for the reader in your life, why not check out one of my books? They're all available on Amazon and most major online book retailers, as well as elsakirk.com.